Oh, Dr. Geed, I'm able to open my hand and hold hands with my husband. Or, Dr. Geed, my husband is able to make me morning breakfast smoothies again. Hey, he made breakfast burritos for the grandkids today. We felt like the old times again. It's these nuggets that's what makes all of this work worthwhile.
Welcome to Border Health Horizons, the podcast where we delve into the dynamic world of health and wellness along the U.S.-Mexico border. I am Dr. Emre Umucu, an associate professor and associate dean for research in the College of Health Sciences.
And I'm Dr. Jason Boyle, associate professor and chair of the Department of Kinesiology. We're excited to have you join us on this journey as we explore the unique health challenges and successes that define our border communities.
On this podcast, we are not just addressing the issues, we are also highlighting the innovative solutions and remarkable individuals who are making a difference in health and well-being on both sides of the border.
So tune in as we uncover stories of resilience, share insights into groundbreaking research, and celebrate the strides being made to improve health outcomes in our vibrant borderlands.
And we are so excited to start this, our first episode, and I would like Jason briefly talk about our guests since I believe they have a similar educational background.
Today's guest is Dr. Shashwati Geed. Dr. Geed is an assistant professor in the Department of Physical Therapy and Movement Sciences here at UTEP. She originally got a degree in physical therapy from India, followed by a PhD in motor control and neuroscience from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and her research focus is on neuroplasticity and stroke rehabilitation.
Dr. Geed, welcome for our first episode, and I am also a UW-Madison graduate, so we have a common theme there. So for our first question, what are some of your most groundbreaking advancements in neuroplasticity that have recently emerged, and how might they transform stroke recovery and cognitive health?
Hi, Dr. Mucho and Dr. Boyle. First of all, thank you for having me and giving us this platform to disseminate some of the exciting work in the fields of neuroplasticity and stroke rehabilitation that we're doing. So, neuroplasticity is the brain's ability to learn something new, to adapt and change in response to a behavioral experience. Some of the most exciting science today is happening in the realms of neuroplasticity in aging and stroke, where studies show that contrary to long-standing dogma, the studies, they're showing that despite aging, the human brain experiences heightened neuroplasticity and learning if it's given the right mix of behaviors, training, and neuromodulation. So it's possible to recreate a brain state conducive to heightened neuroplasticity. One of the most exciting discoveries that we have recently made include our own findings that the human brain goes through what we call a critical period, a brief window of heightened neuroplasticity within the first 3 to 4 months after stroke. This means that the brain is highly, highly adaptable to change during this time, to relearn how to move in the first months after stroke, provided the brain receives the right experiences. We know this because we ran a randomized controlled trial called the Critical Periods After Stroke Study, or CPAS for short, in 72 patients with stroke. We randomized patients to receive the same intensive neuro rehabilitation just at different times after stroke. So patients started receiving therapy at 1 month, 2 to 3 months, or 6 months after their stroke. And what we found was that the groups receiving the intensive PT and OT within 1 and 2 to 3 months recovered significantly more upper extremity function compared to the current standard of care. So the take-home message was that we need to give intensive neuro rehabilitation to patients during the first few months of stroke to amplify the brain's intrinsic capacity to recover. So, but I do, given these results, I do want to emphasize, we are not saying that recovery does not happen at a later time point. Recovery from a stroke or neural injury will happen at any time point whenever we provide neuro rehabilitation. That's called training-related recovery. What we are saying here is there is a critical period when the brain is ready and able to recover much more if only patients received the needed intensive dose of neuro rehabilitation early after a stroke.
And Dr. Geed, before I ask you my next question, I do have something that I find is important to point out of when we talk about these critical periods, what kind of challenges do physical therapists face in encouraging their patients to take their therapy serious during this time, because this is, I would imagine, this is also such a stressful time and a painful time for the patients. So to be motivated to exercise, if you will, that has to be such a huge challenge for the therapist as well, right?
That is absolutely right, Jason. And I'm so glad that you asked this question. It is extremely challenging to provide these levels of intensive rehabilitation so early after stroke. Because imagine you wake up with a stroke, so half of your body is not responding to your brain. It's unable to move. Oftentimes, patients have no idea of where they will go once they are discharged from the hospital because their homes are not adapted for dealing with a wheelchair or a walker or stuff like that. They are tired after stroke, so stroke makes the brain feel very, very tired, exhausted, fatigued. There are these impairments that cause a lot of frustration. So I often tell my patients and my caregivers, more importantly, if you want to experience what it is like to have an impairment, try to go through the rest of your day using your non-dominant hand, using just your left hand instead. It can get very frustrating very quickly. And so it's a mix of all of these psychosocial factors that make it really hard for patients to receive the therapy. Also, sometimes they're not driving this early after stroke. So getting to and from a rehab clinic is a big challenge sometimes. So there's a host of challenges. As therapists, we know now that early therapy is better. The question, the big question in the field now is, how do we provide that therapy efficaciously? How do we provide that intensive dose in a way that the patients won't be tired and they'll be able to complete all of these interventions?
And I want to follow up with what Jason asked. You know, like, I think that was a great question. So I'm just curious, you know, like, we are in El Paso, right? So, and then we believe, you know, like, in this community, there are a lot of people struggling with stroke and some other neurocognitive conditions. And I believe you just started your job, right, as assistant professor here in PT department. My follow-up question is, like, first, how do you motivate your participants who have stroke to come to your clinic or your research program? And also, what would you tell them, especially those who are living in El Paso and then not having real resources, right? So because they don't have enough resources in this region, what would you suggest them, you know, like, for their, you know, like, stroke recovery?
So, yeah, we do have ongoing studies in the department at this time. Some of them are addressing physical activity after stroke. Some of them are addressing cardiovascular exercise and fitness after stroke. My lab is specifically focused on neuroplasticity after stroke and providing upper extremity interventions so that people can improve their hand function and recovery on the motor control side of things. So we have some resources here, some ongoing studies at UTEP in the Department of PT and Movement Sciences. People are welcome to get in touch with us. Our lab website and department website has the contacts and web links for getting in touch with us. All of those studies are active and ongoing studies. We're recruiting and enrolling participants every day.
Yeah, that will be great. I think, like, we have more participants for your research, right? And then you can have, I think, like, better results.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm happy to talk about that later on as well as we delve into it. But some of our studies are dealing with telerehabilitation. So it goes back to Jason's question about how do we motivate patients to do the therapy that we need to do when there is access issues and so on. So we are developing technology to, if the patient can't come to the clinic, then we go to the patient's home. We send the we send an internet-enabled tablet to the patient's home with some sensors and do the therapy remotely. We're getting great success in UTEP trying to do that.
You know, so in the state of Texas, it's a very large state, as you know, since you moved here, and it has an incredibly diverse population. So how can your work in neuroplasticity-based therapy be adapted to be more culturally sensitive and effective for diverse populations, including those with unique cultural backgrounds and health disparities?
Yes, Jason, it is very, very important that neurorehabilitation is salient. Salient, it's a term in neuroplasticity, which means whatever we're doing as neuro rehab with the patients, it has to be personally meaningful and rewarding to the patients. So we know from a lot of the animal studies, successful animal studies in neuroplasticity, that enriched environments and animals are social animals. So if they're housed in cages together in multiple cages, they have room to play and explore and so on. Those mice do better. So trying to translate some of that fundamental basic neuroscience into clinical rehabilitation, we tried to do that with the CPAS trial that I just talked about, and the intervention that we are also implementing here in our studies now at UTEP is it's sort of paradigm shifting, because normally therapists decide what the patient needs in terms of exercise, the stretches, the muscle imbalances, etc. And then those exercises are prescribed to our patients. These activities may have very little to do with the patient's own interests and likes and dislikes, etc., and life in general. So we've turned this paradigm around on its head, and we went to the patients. We complete a structured interview with the patients using an assessment called the activity card sort test. It's a stack of 90 different activities that we know older adults are interested in doing, they have been doing for a long time. And then patients pick and choose the top 10 or top 15 activities that they used to do before the stroke, but now they've lost their ability to do it because of the stroke. So we pick those activities, and then together with these patient preferences on activities and the therapist's clinical judgment, the combination of that, I think, is the way to go. So we pick these patient preferences plus the clinical judgment to design a personalized individual intervention plan for each study participant to try to do these therapy rehabilitation. And it also goes back to what Jason was talking about earlier about how do we keep the patients motivated to do these activities, so to do so much therapy. So this salience piece being culturally meaningful to them, it's central to the patients feeling meaningful, the patients feeling motivated to want to do these activities and so on. So it's known to engage the reward circuitry in the brain. It's known to lead to better motor outcomes after a stroke.
You know, that seems like in motor learning and control, even at, you know, an undergraduate class, one of the things that you teach students is that if you're a coach and you're working with athletes, to let your athletes have a role in when they receive feedback, and to feel like they have a role in different activities they may do in practice. You know, of course, everything is guided by the expert, but when you let the, you know, in this case, this is the athletes, play a serious role in the development of this is what we're gonna do, they respond so much better. Mm-hmm. And you know, you see these things in curriculum as well, like, right, hey, here's how we're gonna run the class. What do you think? Should we do this assignment or that assignment? You know, it's still guided by the expert, but it's amazing how you've taken that principle with reward circuitry, mm-hmm, and given your patients autonomy to also play a role in their rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. But so being in the driver's seat about their own recovery, that kind of, and the engagement of the reward circuitry, the meaningfulness of the activities that they're doing for therapy, we feel that it's the combination of some of these factors that has led to so much success of this intervention.
So my next question is, I think, like, it's all related to, you know, like what you explained, like you are using some technologies, right? So to motivate your participants to come into your clinic and research program. And now we in this world, now we have virtual reality, artificial intelligence is really improving and developing, right? So I'm just like really curious to what extent you are interested on using, you know, like AI and virtual reality for not just reaching like El Paso community, but also, you know, like rural Paso del Norte region, you know, like communities. So what do you do about that?
Yes, that is a very, very important and a high priority goal for our lab. So fair access to neurorehabilitation is really, really important. It's especially so if you consider the scale and the magnitude of disabilities after stroke.
Mm-hmm.
A stroke occurs in the United States approximately once every 40 seconds.
Wow.
And nearly two-thirds of those patients will experience some upper extremity movement impairments all the way up to 6 months or longer after stroke. So that means these patients are limited in their independence. They have limited abilities to complete their activities of daily living, like feeding, dressing, driving, meal prep, and just be independent and be fully engaged in their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge burden to carry for anybody. And we are investing our research resources into virtual reality and artificial intelligence because we think it can help bring efficacious rehabilitation to patients that need it the most. So we are in fact running a follow-up study in our lab right now, which is translating the CPAS intervention
mm-hmm.
into a telerehabilitation model of delivery right here in El Paso at UTEP. This study was necessary because we knew that the brain's window of high neuroplasticity lasted a very short time. Often it is 2 to 3 months after stroke, about 4 months if you stretch it a little. This time period is really prime for the brain to recover, but this is also the time when patients are not driving to and from a clinic because of the disability. They often have been discharged from inpatient rehabilitation and they're waiting for outpatient rehab to start. Very often they are waiting for license, for insurance clearances and so on also. So it seemed like when we had these results on neuroplasticity, we wanted to provide the therapy to patients in our studies. But in the standard of care model, we were realizing, okay, hey, the patients are unable to access therapy in the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we get this therapy to the patients rather than just have them sitting at home doing nothing? So we started working in the telerehabilitation realm. And basically, we are enrolling individuals who have experienced a stroke
mm-hmm.
to receive this telerehabilitation intervention at UTEP. All we are doing is shipping off a tablet that is wireless,
mm-hmm.
Internet-enabled tablet, and two sensors that are like smartwatches that they wear on their wrists. And patients are receiving therapy using HIPAA-safe modalities
mm-hmm.
like Doxy or Zoom, etc. And the sensors that they wear on their wrist allow them to kind of send almost instant data back to the lab in terms of this is how much they moved today, this is how the therapy is going. So in that sense, all of that technology is really useful.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having to come to the clinic, let's say 30 times in a month, now it can be cut down to 10 times or 5 times in a month, where they just come in for an initial baseline assessment. We train them with the technology, how to use the tablet, how to connect to Zoom, etc., how to wear the watches, send them back home. And then the therapist Zooms with our patients and provides telerehab
mm-hmm.
over this month-long period. At the end of it, they come back to the clinic and we look at their data again in person. So, and surprisingly, this is only pilot data. This
mm-hmm.
is very preliminary, but we're finding it's working better here in El Paso. Telerehabilitation is seemingly working better than in person for now in terms of its feasibility.
That's great. It's fascinating, you know, like our institution and, you know, like college and department is, you know, like able to support this great research initiative for
mm-hmm.
sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like it would really be beneficial for those that live in rural
mm-hmm.
areas as well, you know, that getting to the city is a very big task.
Yes, we've had patients who have had to, like, drive an hour or more otherwise just to get to a clinic. But they've been able to do that and use the tablets to get regular therapies and have some improvements.
Now, everyone at this table, we all love research and we love theoretical models and we like statistical designs but to the general audience, it's always fair for people to say so what, right? When it comes to research, so. In my experience, the so what, especially in the field that you're in, is always these inspiring or success stories. And so in your case, can you share a story where you've seen neuroplasticity significantly improve a patient's quality of life? And, what are some of the lessons that we can learn from the case that apply to broader contexts?
Oh, yeah. I think that is the best part of this job as a neurorehabilitation scientist. The kindness, the resilience, and the generosity of some of these patients to keep bringing their best every day in spite of all of the setbacks that they've experienced, that is truly inspiring. We've had several patients now here at UTEP in our lab who have participated in our telerehabilitation study. And it's the things that they tell us that they're able to do now. Oh, Dr. Geed, I'm able to open my hand and hold hands with my husband. Or, Dr. Geed, my husband is able to make me morning breakfast smoothies again. These are just some comments that the patients or their caregivers have given us. Or, hey, he made breakfast burritos for the grandkids today. We felt like the old times again. It's these nuggets that's what makes all of this work worthwhile. We've had patients who had to cut back on their job hours significantly as a result of not being able to move their arms as they needed to. And some of them are slowly getting back into work again and feel productive and be independent again. And these individual experiences are really big. They're really rewarding. Some of the best pieces of our work, to be honest.
Wow. And it seems like you are touching so many people's lives meaningfully and then helping them have better quality of life.
Yeah, I agree. Dr. Geed's pioneering research offers hope and new possibilities for improving health outcomes, especially in underserved communities. I really think the future of helping people, and out here in El Paso, it's a big city, but it is definitely on an island out in the desert. And West Texas has such a need and such a lack of healthcare access, to be honest. So her insights into how neuroplasticity can be harnessed to address both stroke recovery and age-related cognitive decline is truly inspiring.
And Jason, I want to ask you something, as I know you are coming from kinesiology field, right? So you have a similar background with Dr. Geed. What is your vision for the future impact of neuroplasticity research?
I think it's everything. As a new master's student in graduate school, I'll always remember watching a video of a quadriplegic patient. She was moving a robotic arm and was grabbing a bottle of water and was giving herself something to drink. And that has always stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And, so the future of neuroplasticity, how we can tap into it, and ultimately how patients can regain function. Because it kept getting brought up again and again and again of the satisfaction of being independent, your ability to feel like you're living a meaningful life. That's everything to these people. And when they have a neural insult, a neural injury that takes that away from them, that's as great as it gets for me as far as this field. What do you think, MRA, can be done to make neuroplasticity therapies more accessible to those in need?
So, I'm a mental health professional and psychologist, and I'm also serving as associate dean for research. So I always think about bringing more resources to, our institution and our college to, help researchers like Dr. Geed to conduct more research studies, to really understand not just for those who have stroke, but also individuals experiencing spinal cord injury, traumatic brain injury, or even cancer, diabetes. So I'm really wondering what other studies can be done in our college and in our region to really outreach more and more individuals who are in greater need for neuroplasticity research. And I have been also thinking more about what Dr. Geed was mentioning regarding technology use and AI. I think we have a lot of communities and people living in rural and frontier locations in, you know, like Paso del Norte region. And I believe we need to invest more promoting technology use like telehealth, virtual reality, or even bringing like some researchers here conducting AI research for neuroplasticity. And I think that will be really, really meaningful for our region, for our communities, and for people who are living in neurocognitive conditions, I think. We would really like to extend a heartfelt thank you to you, Dr. Geet, for sharing your groundbreaking, you know, like work on neuroplasticity and its impact on stroke recovery, aging, and our community as well.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
This is our first episode. Again, if you enjoyed today's episode and want to stay updated on the latest in health and wellness along the border, please be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We have got more engaging conversations and expert guests lined up for you.
And remember, whether you're in a border community or beyond, the strides we're making in health are relevant to all of us. Thanks for tuning in to Border Health Horizons. Until next time, stay informed and stay well. I'm actually comfortable like being like this.
Okay.
This is Jason's mic.
Okay.
I got to do another one. I can't. It can't sit well with me.
I'm sorry.